Welcome, everyone. This is session number 7 of our series on Parshanut and polemics on Bible commentaries, Jewish Bible commentaries, and the extent to which they took on Christianity. And so this is session 7 out of 10, but it is also session 2 out of 2 about Rashbam, my favorite Bible commentator. And I will begin today's session just by reviewing some of the things that we saw about Rashbam and Christianity in the previous session. Just to review, Rashbam, Rabbi Samuel ben Meir, was Rashi's grandson, a great Talmudist, and perhaps the commentator will emphasize pshat, the simple meaning of the Torah, in his commentary on the Torah, more than any other medieval commentary. This commentary almost got lost. It was found in one manuscript at the end of the 17th century by the bibliophile Rabbi David Oppenheim. The earliest editions of Mikraot Gedolot, of the compendium of traditional commentators, never had Rashbam in them because the printers did not have access to Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. And Rashbam has made a little bit of a comeback in the 20th and the 21st centuries. And I'm not the only scholar in the world who takes a particular interest in Rashbam's commentary. To review, Rashi's Torah commentary mentions Christians never. There's no mention, no direct mention of Christianity anywhere in Rashi's Torah commentary. In Rashi's commentary on the later books of the Bible, we do find some references to what the Christians say about the text. Scholars argue about whether Rashi is taking on Christianity in his Torah commentary also, even though he never mentions Christianity. I'm of the opinion that he isn't, that that's not his agenda. But his grandson is perhaps the first Torah commentator who took on Christianity in the Torah commentary, saying, here's what the Christians say, and here's what I said to the Christians. Last week, we saw three examples of this in Rashbam's Torah commentary. And to just review quickly those three examples, on the verse when Jacob is blessing his sons at the end of Bereshit, when he says to Judah, Lo yasur shevet mi Yehuda umchokek mi bin raglav ad ki yavo shilo v'lo yikat amim. In the old King James translation here, the scepter shall not depart from Judah, nor a lawgiver from between his feet, until Shiloh come, and unto him shall be the gathering of people. So that's a translation made by somebody who's actually trying to put a Christian reading into the verse and trying to suggest that, you know, the King James translation was, of course, a translation that was made of the Bible into English for Christians. And Shiloh was seen as being a reference to Jesus. And we carefully read through Rashbam's comment on this passage last time. Just see that towards the end of his long comment here, he says directly, this interpretation constitutes a refutation of the Minim. I offered this commentary because I know what the Christians are saying about this passage. And if you read this, what I say on it, it refutes everything that the Minim, his word for the Christians, say. And he goes on to say that when the Christians say that that the word Shiloh in this verse means a messenger, which is what you see here in the bottom right-hand corner. If those of you who know Latin, qui mittendus est, the one who was sent. He says, well, Shiloh and Shalach aren't the same word. Shiloh ends with a hey, and Shalach ends with a chet, so it's not the same word. So they're wrong in their understanding here. So we see here, A, that he's taking on the Christian interpretation, and B, that he knows what it says in the Vulgate, in the official Latin translation of the Bible. Okay, so here's our first example of Rashbam taking on Christianity. And this is in a passage that many Christians try to cite as proof that the what they call the Old Testament, the Hebrew Bible, predicts the coming of Jesus. And so here he says, I'm helping you. It's as if in some senses, Rashbam's commentary on the Torah is being presented to its readers as a primer of how you can argue against the Christians. So here's the first example that we saw last week. To continue our review of what we saw last week, we also saw that in his commentary on Lo Tirzach, on the sixth of the Ten Commandments, which sometimes is translated as thou shalt not kill, and sometimes is translated as thou shalt not murder, Rashbam insists that it has to mean murder. It can't mean kill. And he says here, just reading the English on the right-hand side, I offered this explanation as an argument against the Minim, against the heretics, against the Christians, and they admitted that I was right. We will see other examples today of Rashbam describing conversations that he had with Christians, and all surprisingly, in all of the descriptions that he gives of conversations that he had with the Christians, they always admit to him that he is right. We don't have the Christians' records of those conversations. We don't know if they also said that they admitted that he was right, but he's saying that he had a conversation with them and that I pointed out to them that there is a mistake in the Vulgate, that they use that same verb. If you look on the left-hand side of the Latin, we have non occides for the sixth of the Ten Commandments, and we have God saying in the book of Deuteronomy, ego okadam, I shall kill. And there are two different verbs there. There's ratzach for the first one, which we generally translate as murder. And God would not say, I murder. God says, I kill those who deserve to die. And so again, Rashbam is showing knowledge of Christianity and showing that, you know, he knows better than the Christians what the Hebrew means. And of course, he knew Hebrew much better than the Christians that he was talking to in northern France in the 12th century. And now this verse here, thou shalt not kill or thou shalt not murder, that it's different than the last example here. Genesis 49:10 is a verse that was specifically used by Christians for a Christian purpose of saying that Jesus was predicted in the book of Genesis. Here, there's no particular Christian message here, but it's just Rashbam trying to make the point that many Jewish polemicists, many Jews who argued against Christianity made, a point that is, I think, an extremely strong point, that we know the Bible a lot better. We know biblical Hebrew. They don't know biblical Hebrew. And when they make a claim about what's written in the Hebrew Bible, they're doing it on the basis of faulty understanding of Hebrew. So these are two different points. Here's the point of, does the Hebrew Bible predict the coming of Jesus? And so Rashbam says no, and here's what you should say to any Christian who says that this verse is predicting the coming of Jesus. And in general, you can say to the Christians that they don't understand the Hebrew of the Hebrew Bible as well as we understand the Hebrew of the Hebrew Bible. And the third example that we saw last week was the example of the verse we read in the Parsha a number of weeks ago, each woman shall sha'al from her neighbor and from the lodger in her house, objects, silver and gold and clothing, and you shall put those objects on your sons and daughters, thus stripping the Egyptians. Rashbam says that sha'al here does not mean to borrow. It means to ask as an outright and absolute gift. Then he tries to prove that that can be a legitimate meaning of the Hebrew verb sha'al. And he's right. There are two meanings of sha'al in modern, in biblical Hebrew, in rabbinic Hebrew, and in modern Hebrew. It can mean to ask that something be given to you with no intention of returning it, or ask for it to be given to you with an intention of returning it. And he writes at the bottom, this interpretation is the true plain meaning of the verse, and it's also an appropriate rebuttal for the minim, for the heretics, for the Christians. So what kind of issue is at stake here? Presumably the issue at stake here is that the Christians are claiming that the Jews have always been immoral kind of people. And you can go back to the Bible and see the Jews behaving immorally and saying that they're borrowing items from the Egyptians when they had no intention of ever returning these items to the Egyptians. And they didn't return these items to the Egyptians. And so Rashbam is trying to come to the defense of the morality of Jews against accusations that we know were heard. I mentioned last week that I actually have not succeeded in finding a Christian before or at the time of Rashbam who offered a kind of anti-Jewish understanding of this verse that needed to be refuted by Rashbam. But we have many examples of Jews and Christians arguing about which religion is the more moral religion. And Rashbam, obviously wanting to claim that Judaism is the more moral religion, offers this explanation and is saying that the interpretation here is correct and it's also useful for arguing against Christianity. So the three types that we saw last week were Rashbam refuting a Christological understanding of a text from the Torah, Rashbam trying to argue that the Jews have a better understanding of biblical Hebrew than the Christians do. So Christians are saying something about what's going on in the Bible, but they just don't know Hebrew very well. That they're using a mistaken text. The Vulgate, the official Latin translation of the Torah is mistaken. And then the third point, which, as I said, shows up a fair amount in medieval Jewish Christian polemics, arguments about which of the religions is actually the more moral kind of religion. I'm trying to mute everyone here. Yes. Okay. Good. So those are the three themes that we saw last week. Today, we will continue and look at all of the rest of the text where Rashbam makes a reference to the Christians, and all of them fall into the same category. The first example that we'll see is from the book of Deuteronomy. Just read it in English to save time. If along the road you chance upon a bird's nest in any tree or on the ground with fledglings or eggs and the mother sitting over the fledglings or on the eggs, do not take the mother together with her young. Let the mother go and take only the young in order that you may fare well and have a long life. In his commentary on this verse, Shiluach HaKen, this mitzvah of not taking the mother and the young together, Rashbam writes, do not take the mother together with her young. I already offered this explanation, which is both in conformance with the way of the world and also appropriate for rebutting the minim. Lefi derech eretz v'li tshuvat haminim. So the explanation that I'm offering here, first of all, it makes sense from our experience in the world, from the way we all know that the world works. And it's so aside from being like a good natural explanation of this mitzvah, it's also appropriate to use in an argument against the Christians. Kvar perashti, I'll go back to the English. I already offered this explanation concerning boiling a kid in its mother's milk, lo tvashel gadi b'chalei bimo, or slaughtering it and its young, the mitzvah that says that you're not allowed to slaughter the mother and its young on the same day. This behavior, either taking the mother and the young together, that's what it's talking about here in this verse with Shiluach HaKen, of letting the mother go free before taking the young, either taking the mother and the young together, or slaughtering them together on the same day, or cooking them together. All these three things are forbidden because it appears cruel and gluttonous. Why are these things forbidden? You know, to be so greedy that you want to kill the mother and kill the young, or take the mother and take the young, or boil the baby in its mother's milk. This is disgusting. It's cruel. It's gluttonous, and that's why the Torah forbids this. Okay, so Rashbam says here, this explanation is lefi derech eretz, the natural kind of explanation, but he also says it's lichuvat haminim. It's appropriate for rebutting the minim, for rebutting what the Christians have to say. We'll get back to the question in a second about what it is that the Christians might be saying about this law, that Rashbam feels the necessity of rebutting. But notice he has categorized these three mitzvot together. Taking the mother bird together with her young, slaughtering a mother sheep on the same day that you slaughter her child, the baby sheep, or boiling a baby goat in its mother's milk. He categorizes the three of them together and says that the explanation that I offered is useful to refute what the Christians have to say. A scholar named Elazar Tuito of blessed memory here in Israel, in a book that he wrote on Rashbam, pointed out, I think, something very true. So this is Rashbam's commentary that we just saw. This is Rashbam's commentary on Deuteronomy. In Rashbam's commentary on Shmot, on Exodus, in the commentary just on last week's Parsha on Lo Tevashel Gedi B'Chalev Imo, not boiling a kid in its mother's milk, Rashbam writes, it's disgraceful and voracious and gluttonous to consume the mother's milk together with its young. This law is comparable to the law of not slaughtering it and its young, the mother animal and the baby animal on the same day, and to letting the mother go, the birds, Shiluach HaKen. The text gave this commandment or these commandments in order to teach you how to behave in a civilized manner. So that's what's going on here, is trying to teach human beings to be moral and to be compassionate and to be civilized. But notice that here in the commentary on Exodus, he doesn't say that he's offering this explanation as a refutation of what the Christians said. Here in the commentary on Deuteronomy, he says this is useful to refute the Christians. Here in Exodus, he doesn't mention the fact that it's useful to refute the Christians. From this, Professor Tuito concluded, and I think he is absolutely right, not every anti-Christian comment in Rashbam's commentary on the Torah is labeled as an anti-Christian comment, because we see that this comment is not described here in the commentary on Exodus as being a refutation of what the Christians have to say. And the same comment in this commentary on Deuteronomy is described as being a refutation of the Christians. From this, we learn that sometimes Rashbam takes on Christianity without telling us that he is taking on Christianity. And the only examples that I've collected for you in last week's session and this week's session, until we get to the end of this week's session, all of the comments that I collected are places where Rashbam says explicitly that he's taking on Christianity. Elazar Tuito says, and I think he's right, that Rashbam was probably taking on Christianity in other passages, and then it would be speculative. Here, there's a really strong argument because we see that he says the same idea twice, once in the commentary on Deuteronomy, once in the commentary on Exodus, and he calls one of them a refutation of Christianity. Okay, so here, it's a very strong argument. In other places, it would be a speculative argument to say that that Rashbam is taking on Christianity. So what does it mean to say that this commentary, this explanation of Rashbam is a refutation of what the Christians had to say? So what were the Christians saying? So all the way back in the First Corinthians and Paul's first letter to the Corinthians in the New Testament, we see an argument which will show up in Christian texts throughout classical times, throughout medieval times, and even in modern times. This is specifically about the mitzvah that says, look at the fourth line here, it is written in the law of Moses, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. To which Paul says, is it about oxen that God is concerned? Does God care about oxen, that it's cruel for an ox to be treading the grain and to be muzzled so that it can't eat the grain? Does God care about oxen? Obviously, God doesn't care about oxen. And because of this, we have to allegorize this line when it says, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. Paul argues what it means here is that if you got a soldier, should the soldier serve at his own expense? A person who plants a vineyard for the owner of the property, doesn't he get any pay for it? A person who tends a flock, doesn't he get to drink some of the milk? Paul is arguing here that somebody who does the work of the church should be able to get a salary, should be able to get support from his congregants from doing the work of the church. And his proof is from the verse in the Bible that says, do not muzzle an ox while it is treading out the grain. And that's why in the last line here of the text, he says, if others have this right of support from you, shouldn't we have it all the more? Those of us who are doing the work of the church, shouldn't we be able to get support from the community? And so this kind of method of how to relate to laws that appear in the Torah and saying that these laws that appear in the Torah are actually allegorical, that they are not meant to be taken literally because, you know, it just doesn't make any sense to say that God is worried about oxen. Why would God be worried about oxen? Therefore, an allegorical interpretation is called for. And certainly the Christians made arguments like that about things like basar b'chalav, of not boiling a kid in its mother's milk, saying, you know, why would God care about doing something like this? Obviously, this has to be an allegory. And so many Jews, like Rashbam, felt a requirement in order to defend Judaism to show that the laws of the Torah, even the ones that don't look to be particularly rational, actually do have a rational reason behind them. And so Rashbam is explaining that he's getting into the business of ta'amei mitzvot, of explaining the reasons for individual commandments, because that's one of the essential points of difference between Judaism and Christianity, that the Christians are arguing that these laws have to be taken allegorically, and the Jews are saying, no, these laws are meant to be taken literally, and if they're meant to be taken literally, then you have to come up with a reason behind the law. Dating back as far as the second century, Justin Martyr, one of the church fathers, in a dialogue that he has with a Jew who he refers to as Trypho. The assumption is that this dialogue is fictitious. People wrote in the genre of a dialogue. So Justin is the Christian who's arguing with Trypho, who is the Jew, and he puts words into Trypho's mouth in the middle of this dialogue when they're talking about various mitzvot in the Torah. So he has the Jew saying in this dialogue, "It doesn't seem good to me as it does to most Jews only to say that it was God's will." That you see a mitzvah and then you say, well, what's the idea behind that mitzvah? You say, well, that's what God wants. I don't know why. And so in this dialogue written by a Christian, he's putting words into his Jewish interlocutor's mouth saying, you know, I never liked it when Jews just said it's God's will. And then he has this Jew say, this is always the sly stock reply of those who cannot answer the question. So Rashbam, understanding that defending Judaism meant explaining what the idea is behind various mitzvot, he gives many explanations of mitzvot in his commentary on the Torah. And he explains that these explanations are being given as a refutation against Christianity. So when Rashbam says that these explanations are useful to refute what the Christians are saying, presumably the Christians are saying that these are all allegorical. When Rashbam says, no, there is a reason for it. The question is, does he really believe that he has put his finger on the true explanation of the reason for the mitzvah? Or is he simply saying, if you find yourself in a discussion with Christians, here is something useful that you can say? I don't really know the answer to that question. I don't think anybody knows the answer to that question, whether Rashbam fully believed that he had found the true reason for the mitzvah. His grandfather, Rashi, often said directly that various mitzvot in the Torah are mitzvot that she'ein lahem ta'am, that chukim, the things that are described as chukim, are explanations that do not, are laws that do not have a reason for them. Many people are uncomfortable with Rashi's language. Rashi says directly, she'ein lahem ta'am, that do not have a reason. And many Jews, when they see that, they start to squirm a little bit and they say, well, actually, Rashi doesn't mean that they don't have a reason. What he means is we don't know what the reason is. But his grandson, Rashbam, never says that there is a mitzvah, she'ein la ta'am, that doesn't have a reason. And it is possible because he realized the significance of this in discussions with Christians who were saying, yeah, these rules don't have any reason for them. And that's why we know that they are to be understood as allegories and not to be taken literally. Perhaps that was the motivation for him to get involved in the whole area of Ta'ameh HaMitzvot. So we'll see a few more examples of Rashbam offering these kinds of explanations in his discussion in Parshat Shmini in Leviticus chapter 11, the rules of Kashrut. He says, following the plain meaning of scripture, and as a useful rebuttal of the minim, lefi pshuto shel mikra utshuvat haminim, it may be argued that all the animals, domesticated and not domesticated, birds, fish, locusts and insects, which God forbade to the Israelites, were forbidden because they are repulsive. Me'usim hein. They damage and heat up the body. Eating these things is bad for you. That is why they are called impure. Lefichach nikru'u tmeim. And then he adds, v'af rofim muvhakim omrim kein. Outstanding physicians also concur with this explanation. the person who famously said that the rules of kashrut were in order to encourage Jews to eat healthy food and to stay away from things that are unhealthy. Rambam said this, but Rambam lived quite a few years after after Rashbam. Rambam was maybe 25 or 30 years old when Rashbam died. And so Rashbam is actually the first person that I know who offered this explanation, which I, with all the love that I have for Rashbam and his commentary on the Torah, I don't really think that this is one of the most successful explanations of what the reason is behind a mitzvah. But and did Rashbam believe that that's actually the reason for this when he says outstanding physicians also concur with this explanation? Maybe he really did believe this. Today there are many many people who really do not like this kind of explanation, this kind of Ta'amei HaMitzvot explanation, because our knowledge of what is healthy and what is unhealthy has certainly changed quite a bit since the 12th century, and so it's not clear that this was the best strategy to defend Judaism against the attacks of the Christians, but this is the one that Rashbam chose, and he did it because he heard what the Christians were saying, which is, it's nonsensical to observe these rules of kashrut. And obviously these rules are to be understood as an allegory, and that if it says, don't eat a pig, it means don't behave like a pig, or whatever allegorical explanation was offered by Christians for these texts. Moving on to the next example. Rashbam, continuing in his commentary there on Parshat Shmini at the end of Leviticus chapter 11, I'll read in English. A person who wishes to give reasons for the commandments in a manner that conforms to the way of the world and it is appropriate for rebutting the Minim may explain this verse as follows. God did not attach the concept of impurity to any food or drink until they have been rendered usable as food. Rashbam is not talking about here, the Torah is not talking here about kosher and non-kosher, it's talking about tameh and tahor, pure and impure. And at the end of Leviticus chapter 11, it says that something that grows from the ground cannot become impure when it touches something impure. It doesn't become impure unless it has come in contact with water before that. That's said clearly at the end of Leviticus chapter 11, and that looks very strange. And do you want an explanation here? Rashbam says, bringing them in contact with water is the first step in their preparation and the true way that they are to be promoted to the status of foodstuffs. Ikar chashivutam letzorech achila. General understanding of the rules of purity and impurity is that nature cannot become impure. Human beings can become impure. A tree can't become impure, but food can become impure. Things, when they're still part of nature, they can't become impure. But once they become something that can be used by a human being, at that point, they're susceptible to becoming impure. And that happens. The first step in preparing any kind of foodstuff is generally adding some water to it. And that's why it says at the end of chapter 11, V'chiyutan mayim al zera v'nafal meniv la'tola, that if some seeds come in contact with water and then they come in contact with something that's impure, then the seeds become impure. But if the seeds have not been in contact with water, so an explanation that can be useful when you get into a discussion with the Christians is that this is the first step in turning them into food. I remember the first time that I saw this comment many years ago, I said, oh, I always thought that's what my teachers taught me was the principle here. I guess Rashbam came up with this idea, and it's become common to teach this. I think my Gemara teachers, when they explained Tuma and Tahara, impurity to me many years ago, used this principle. But Rashbam is saying here, this is an explanation that conforms to the way of the world and that's appropriate for rebutting the claims of the Christians. And that's why he's offering it here. Again, seeing that he understands that he's providing a primer here of arguments the Jews can use against the Christians if they find themselves in discussions with Christians. Moving on to the next example, the verse that talks about kilayim or shatnez, the forbidden mixtures in Leviticus chapter 19. In Parshat Kedoshim, et chukotai tishmoru. So here's that word chukotai that I told you Rashi says, he says here and in a few other places, chukotai means these are things that do not have any reason for them. That's what it is. That's what it means to say that a law is a chuk. That means that it doesn't have any reason for it. But if we when we flip to the next slide, you'll see that Rashbam doesn't go along with his grandfather on this, and he feels the necessity of trying to explain the idea behind these laws, despite the fact that they are called a chok, and that Rashi says that they don't have an explanation. And Rashbam will tell us that he's offering this explanation as a refutation for what the Christians are saying. Okay, what are these chukim here? You shall not let your cattle mate with a different kind. You shall not sow your field with two kinds of seed. You shall not put on cloth from a mixture of two kinds of material. Later on in Devarim, it's explained that the problem with cloth, if it's a mixture of linen and wool, something the cloth that comes from the ground and cloth that comes from an animal, that's a forbidden mixture. So that's the verse here. And again, as I said, Rashi says, we don't know the reasons for this. So Rashbam writes here, an explanation that is in conformance with the way of the world and that is appropriate for rebutting the minim is. You want an explanation? I'll give you one that's, you know, logical and natural and that it conforms with, you know, the things that we know about the world in which we live, and that's appropriate when the Christians say to you, obviously you shouldn't be observing these rules literally because they don't make any sense. So here's the explanation. Just as scripture in the creation story commanded each species to produce fruit according to its kind, limino, so it commanded that we conduct the affairs of the world in a similar manner when it comes to animals or fields or fruit trees or plowing with an ox and an ass, two separate species together. So the Torah teaches us in the first chapter that when God created the world, he wanted the species to remain limino, liminam, according to its own kind. And I guess as a kind of form of imitatio Dei, of us copying the ways of God, we should also keep the different species here in the world separate from one another. This explanation actually was offered before Rashbam. It was offered by Philo of Alexandria, the Jewish philosopher who lived around the year one, whose life spanned the BCE years and the CE years, and who who wrote in Greek and who was not part of the rabbinic tradition, but he was a great explainer of Judaism. Clearly, Rashbam did not read Philo of Alexandria. Jews in the standard Jewish community between around the year 300, 400 and the 17th, 18th century, no Jews were reading Philo of Alexandria. Philo of Alexandria's works were actually preserved by the church and not by Jews. But curiously, both Philo and Rashbam came up with this explanation that keeping the species separate from each other is a way of imitating the creative act of God, who the book of Genesis tells us wanted things to be liminehu, limino, limina. Okay, so yet another example of Rashbam offering an explanation that is an attempt to rationalize mitzvot in order to refute the claims of the Christians. However, in the continuation, he says something a little surprising. He says, "Vegam tzemru fishtim shezemin behemot vezemin karka vegidulav." Similarly, one should explain the restriction against wearing wool and linen together in one garment. It is outlawed because it's an illicit combination of two categories, as the former is from an animal and the latter is from the category of things that grow in the ground. So there are some things that we get from the animal world and some things that we get from the vegetable world, and never the twain shall meet. They're not going to, they should be kept separate from one another. Okay, that line there goes along pretty well with what he said about liminehu, about remaining true to one's own kind, true to one's own species in that first line. But then at the end here, he says something a little surprising. V'laminim amarti. To the minim, I said. So he's telling us about a conversation that he had with the Christians on this subject. So the Christian said, "Can you explain, you know, what's the idea here?" I said that the text outlawed clothing of two different colors. For wool is generally colored, but linen is not. They accepted this explanation. "L'alminim amarti atzimer tzavua, pishtan einenu tzavua, v'kapid bebeget shel shnei marot." So what's he saying here? I think he's writing this commentary here in rabbinic Hebrew, and obviously the audience of this commentary is Jews. Those are the ones who read rabbinic Hebrew. And he's saying, like, so you want to know what the idea, you Jewish reader, you want to know what it is? Here's the idea. The idea is that species should be kept separate from one another. Okay. But let me tell you, one time I got in a discussion with the Christians and I told them that actually the principle here is that wool is generally colored and linen generally isn't colored, and clothing that has two different colors is not accepted by the Torah. And the Christians said, "Oh yeah, that makes sense." It's as if he's saying to you, if you find yourself in a discussion with the Christians, here's something effective that you can say to them, but that's not the explanation. You want to know what the explanation is. There are a lot of Talmudic texts of this nature where a rabbi is asked a question by some Roman, and then he gives the answer, and then the students turn to him afterwards and say, "Rabbeinu, oto dachita bekaneshel kash." Okay, you gave a weak argument that was able to satisfy that Roman who asked you that question. But now we're asking you that question. You got something to say to us that will be a stronger argument. And then the rabbi gives an explanation that's a better explanation to give to a Jewish audience. So it's as if Rashbam is saying here, there are explanations that I'm giving to my Jewish audience, but those of you who find yourself in a conversation with Christians, you might want to use another argument, and here's one that could work with them. It was not very common in medieval Europe for people other than royalty to have clothing that was of more than one color. And that's the argument that Rashbam is saying that he offered to the Christians, that, you know, you shouldn't be like the king who's got clothing of more than one color. You should decide either to have white clothing or colored clothing. Okay, so we've now reached the end of all of the examples of where Rashbam specifically says that he's taking on Christianity. I'd like to finish off the class here by disagreeing with Professor Tweetu, who I quoted approvingly before. Professor Tweetu, as I said, came up with a very reasonable argument that sometimes Rashbam offers anti-Christian explanations without saying that he's offering anti-Christian explanations. And here's one of Professor Tweetu's arguments. He claims that this explanation of Rashbam was offered for anti-Christian purposes. And I disagree with him on this, but I'll try to present his position and my position on the subject. One recalls in Parshat Achrimot in Leviticus, there's a description of the ceremony that took place on Yom Kippur in the temple where there were two goats. One of them was offered as a sacrifice inside the temple or the tabernacle, and the other one was we refer to as the scapegoat, which is, according to this chapter, it is sent, it is l'shalach otod la'azazel hamidbara, literally to release it to Azazel, whatever Azazel means, in the wilderness. And Rabbinic Judaism explained this. The Talmud explains that it meant that this goat was taken to the top of a very steep cliff and given a push and is pushed off the cliff. And before it gets to the halfway down, it's dead before it hits the ground. Rashbam offers a different interpretation of the text. He writes, I'll just read the English. Those of you who want to follow the Hebrew. According to the plain meaning of scripture, this means to release it alive, to let it go graze with the other goats in the wilderness. It doesn't mean that you kill the second goat. It never says that second goat is killed. All it says is that you release that second. The verb is lishalach, not lishloach, but lishalach, which means to let go, as in when Moses said to Pharaoh, shalach et ami, let my people go. So this goat is released into the desert, into the wilderness. And I'm skipping a little bit here, and I'll come back to it. The word midbar doesn't mean a desert. It means a place where animals graze. And so it is written that Moses led the sheep to the midbar. And also in rabbinic literature, there are two kinds of animals, baitiyot and midbariyot. Baitiyot means an animal that lives in a bayit, that is a domesticated animal. And midbariyot doesn't mean that the animal lives in the desert. It means that it lives not in the city, not where people live. And so the scapegoat is not sent out to die in the wilderness, in the desert. It's sent out to graze. And he goes on to explain, and I didn't give you the whole text here. He says that the word Azazel is related to the word Az, which means goat. And this goat is released to go where the other goats are. And for those of you who have spent time here in Israel, you know, there are wild goats. There's a famous book written called The Wild Goats of Ein Gedi. There are goats that go around grazing. And so in this ceremony, you take two goats, and one of them you offer as a sacrifice. And Rashbam says that the other one you just release to go into goat land, into Azazel. Professor Twito argues that Rashbam offers this explanation because he knows that the Christians already back in the first and the second century and continuing all through the ages, including into the 21st century, you can still find conversionary literature that talks about the scapegoat and saying the Jews can't have any atonement anymore because atonement was effected by killing the scapegoat, and there isn't a scapegoat anymore, and that the scapegoat became Jesus. And so this is the Epistle of Barnabas, one of the church fathers in the first or second century, writing, "Note what was commanded, take two goats, goodly and alike, and offer them, and let the priest take one of them as a burnt offering for sins." But what did they do with the other one? The other, he says, is accursed. Well, it doesn't quite say that in the Torah, but anyways, notice how the type of Jesus is manifested. This is a precursor of Jesus. What does this mean? Listen, the first goat is for the altar, but the second one is accursed, and of a truth, it was he who then said that he was the Son of God. And just as Jesus was cursed and then ended up dying, so also that Jesus has become the scapegoat, the one who atones for us through his death. Professor Twito came up with the fascinating argument that said that Rashbam offered this explanation because he wanted to undercut what the Christians were saying. The Christians were saying that Jesus was the scapegoat here was the precursor of Jesus, was the idea of Jesus dying in order to atone. And Professor Twito argues that Rashbam offers this explanation that the scapegoat didn't die in order to undercut Christianity. It's very creative, but it's just not what Rashbam says. And Rashbam, in my opinion, offers an extremely strong argument. And the part that I skipped here on this slide, it talks about releasing the second goat to go out into the wilderness. This is just like what is done with the bird offerings of the leper. Two chapters before, this is Leviticus 16. In Leviticus 14, it says that when somebody is a metzora, a leper, and then he becomes healed from his leprosy, he's supposed to bring two birds. And one bird is offered as a sacrifice. And the second one, it says, he shall set the live bird free, the shilach et hatzipor hachaya al pnei hasadeh. And Rashbam says, we've got two texts right beside each other in Leviticus. And in one of them, it says that when a leper stops being leprous, he should go through a ceremony where he offers one bird as a sacrifice and releases the second bird. So also, the Jewish people every Yom Kippur should have two goats, one of them that is offered as a sacrifice and the other one that is released. So I am convinced that Rashbam is offering this surprising interpretation of the biblical text, not for anti-Christian purposes. I can't prove, you know, neither Professor Twito nor I can get into Rashbam's mind 800 years later to know precisely what he was thinking. But the argument here seems to be a very strong textual argument. And Rashbam was willing to offer new interpretations of biblical verses that bucked the tradition, that went against the grain of tradition. And I don't think that he's doing it because of what he heard that the Christians were saying. I think he's doing it because he thinks that it's the best interpretation of the biblical verse. This does not mean that there aren't other passages in Rashbam's commentary that he has written the way that he wrote them in order to refute Christianity. I have a little more to say about Rashbam and the Christians, but I am going to save it. First of all, I've run out of time here. I'm going to save it for session 10 out of 10 that will be taking place 3 weeks from now. And if you come back 3 weeks from now, you'll understand why I'm saving that material for 3 weeks from now. I'll just announce now that next week, the class will specifically deal with the Book of Esther. We'll be meeting next week just before Purim on the eve of Ta'anit Esther. And so we will talk about polemics related to the Book of Esther next week. And now I'll take a look at comments that showed up in the chat and relate to them. Okay, somebody asked people to mute themselves. Thank you for saying that. The type of polemic being done now in the current Church of England writings using this passage of Sha'al from Genesis to accuse Jews of stealing from their Egyptian neighbors in this passage interpretation is also used to attack the state of Israel in regard to the Palestinians. Yes, very true. Did Trifo read Lo Tachsom Shor Bidisho, Bidrisho with a resh instead of Bidisho? Good question, Gershon. I don't think so, but he did offer a drash on it. If Rashbam believes that Lo Tavashel Gadi is to teach us civility, then how does he rationalize extending this law to include even eating any meat and milk together, which is not gluttonous? Zev, I don't have an answer to that. Fine question. He did not bother, but he didn't really feel that he had to do that. He just had to counter the Christian claim that obviously these laws were meant to be seen as allegorical. And so he did not have to, in this context, explain how rabbinic literature, he didn't have to justify rabbinic literature. He had to just justify the fact that Jews take these laws as being literal. Kilayim shatnez works for animals and fields. Not clear how it works for cloth. I agree. I'm not sure that it's the strongest argument. And we limited only to wool and linen, not animal derived and plant derived. Okay, there are. I think that those were the standard materials that were used for clothing in those days. Were linen and wool. Is a silk and linen mixture forbidden? No, I don't think that Rashbam would say that. That's a good question. Shiloh is read as shaliach by the Christians. Did they make a connection with the Seir HaMishtaleach, the scapegoat predicted by Isaiah? I don't think so. Wouldn't Rashbam be aware of the description of the scapegoat falling down the mountain and breaking bones and dying? Yes, for sure, Steve, he would know that. And that's the amazing thing about Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. He said, Talmid Chacham, he knows the Gemara a lot better than I know the Gemara. And still, he was willing to offer new interpretations of biblical verses. And, okay, I'll say it. I worry that sometimes when people take a new interpretation like this of Rashbam and say this, he was saying it for anti-Christian purposes, they're kind of trying to give Rashbam a fig leaf to say, you know, okay, he went against rabbinic tradition, but he must have done it because he knew what the Christians were saying, and he must have done it in order to defend Judaism against the attacks of the Christians. Okay, it's true, he was interested in defending Judaism, but he was also interested in offering new interpretations of biblical texts, even when they went against the standard rabbinic understanding, and even if they weren't against Christianity, but just because he was interested in pshat, interested in the plain meaning of the biblical text. Would polyesters be considered earth-derived? I don't know. That's a fine question. It's almost 7 o'clock here, almost 12 o'clock in Toronto, almost 9 a.m. in California. But if anybody wants to unmute themselves and ask a fast question, I'd be happy to listen.
Marty.
Yes, Gershon.
I think, you know, In Shiloh,
Yes.
you have shaliach is the word that Rashbam is referring to, right?
That
Shiloh.
is right. That's how the Christians understood the Vulgate, right? But
And I'm wondering, listen to me, I'm wondering whether the shaliach he's referring to may be an allusion to the Seir HaShaleach, who
okay.
is identified as Jesus.
I hear what you're saying, but Rashbam's comment there is that it doesn't mean shaliach, that the people who say that it means shaliach don't understand Hebrew. The Christians who say that don't understand Hebrew. They saw that word Shiloh and they thought that it meant shaliach and they blew it. And there's a mistake there in the Vulgate. And he's trying to again prove that anybody who
Yes,
knows.
but couldn't that be precisely what the basis of Rashbam's opinion, that he's specifically arguing with that interpretation? That is what I'm suggesting.
That when he says something about the Sa'ir HaMishtaleach, that he's referring back to that. I find that hard to believe, Gershon. Sorry.
Well, you always find what I say hard to believe.
Okay, I will see you all next week. And as I said, we will have a session that will be a little different from the other sessions in this series. Is there research about the polemics between Perush Rashi and Rashbam? Yes, I think that beginning in my doctoral dissertation many years ago, I was looking into this, and I continued to write about it, about the polemics between Rashi and Rashbam. Most recently, I wrote about it in my Hebrew edition of Rashbam's commentary on the Torah. In my introduction, there's a fairly long section about the disagreements between Rashi and Rashbam, and about the extent to which Rashbam's commentary is taking on Christianity. I wish you all a good week, and see those of you who come back next week in a week's time. All the best.